Well, hello out there, everyone in podcast land, and I want everyone to just take a nice collective deep breath, center yourself, and know that we are going to get through this together. That is right. It is the latest episode of Full Disclosure, where we take the latest movie releases and spoil the ever-living hell out of them. And man, oh man, was that disclaimer never needed on a movie more than this one, because we are talking about Avengers Endgame, and we are talking about everything. I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief of the Front Row Network. Here with me to go on this journey, this three-hour epic journey, is Mr. Scott McFarlane. Scott,
what this is, better not be a three-hour epic journey.
Not the show, but I mean the journey of Endgame was 3 hours, and ultimately it was way more than that, you know.
Yeah. And I'm just happy that for the most part I was more right than you. So,
well, that's, yeah, I guess.
Yes. There is no well. Yes, I was more right than you.
Well, the audience shall decide now, won't they? I don't know, man. I don't even know what I was right about. I know that this movie is awesome, though, and also hopefully sharing that opinion, Mr. Steve Sykes, one of the latest writers for FRNpod.com. Steve, what is up, man?
I was righter than both of you.
Well, Steve does have a – he does know, man. He always knows.
Yeah, no, What a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's so much to talk about here, but I am going to just to do some housekeeping here. Of course, if you didn't see our announcement on Friday, we are now an official NPR podcast, which is amazing. Watch our announcement video on our Facebook page. It is an insanely exciting time here on the Front Row Network, and it is just another huge step forward, and we are so honored and humbled to be joining the NPR family. But as with everything here on Full Disclosure, people, we are acting as if you saw this movie with us. We are leaving nothing untouched here. So, all right, this is spoiler heavy. So if you have not seen Avengers Endgame yet, and some at the network haven't even seen Avengers Endgame yet, you need to stop listening. You need to bookmark this, and you need to come back to it later, because there is a lot of stuff you're not going to want spoiled. We are not some, you know, clickbait website wanting people to read our stories. So that is
so it. Every single news website today,
yes,
that
exactly,
put out spoilers on their titles.
Yeah,
I'm looking at you, Entertainment Weekly, Esquire,
yep,
several others,
mm-hmm, Comic Book Resources. Looking,
I have something to say to them, but NPR tells me I can't anymore.
Exactly. See, that is playing for the team right there. All right. So as with always, that is it. You have been warned. Full disclosure on Avengers Endgame starts in 3, 2, 1.
Cap doesn't die.
He will eventually, I think.
But. Oh, okay. Okay, yes. Every character in narrative history will die eventually.
That's a fair point, sir. That is a fair point. So, whew, man, where do we even begin here? This movie spans, you know, obviously it's a 3-hour movie, but it also culminates 21 films, a decade's worth of filmmaking, multiple successful franchises, the most A-list cast I think I've ever seen in a movie. And I'll just start it off here with our first impressions of the movie. I really don't know how Marvel keeps doing this, and I don't know how the Russos pulled the landing off this well, but this movie is every single thing that I wanted it to be, and even more. It does not leave anything back. It doesn't hold anything back. We get very, very good resolutions to the characters that we lose. We get very good story beats and very good building of the universe. And it is really just an amazing, amazing achievement in filmmaking, I think. And I will get into specifics more, but to anybody who's seen it, like, you know what you felt when you watched this movie. And it is profound. It is exciting, excuse me. And I think that I'm going to need to watch this movie about 1,500 more times before I can fully appreciate the breadth of it. Steve, let's go to you next. What were your overall big takeaway from Avengers Endgame as a movie?
I think that this was basically written for fans of,
yeah,
the series, almost to the point of how fan service-y can we get. And I don't say that in a negative way.
Right.
But there were just so many moments that fans of the series would just be like, completely overcome by. And they nailed it in that respect. The lead performances, the core six, each got some emotional, amazingly emotional beats in. It was almost like a SAG Award for your consideration reel for each right. of them, for Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. especially, but Widow, Hawkeye, they had their moments. Mark Ruffalo, again, showed why he was the perfect Hulk. Lots of meat for the fans to chew on.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, what about you? Your overall impressions of Avengers Endgame?
It was terrible. I hate it. No.
Yeah,
ditto. I mean, this was truly a culmination of 10 years of film. And every single film, every single character to Hydra guy number 5 in The Winter Soldier got a moment in this movie.
Yep.
And, you know, they did so well keeping it quiet. No one expected Robert Redford to frickin' show up.
Right.
But there
that
he is.
Was impressive.
I want to point out, by the way, Robert Redford came in and filmed a new scene. Natalie Portman can't be allowed to do that.
I wondered
so,
about that.
Yeah, that's, you know, whatever. But no, I really enjoyed it. Much like I said with Infinity War, no matter your character, that is your favorite character, they get a moment to shine. Even if one of your favorite character was dusted, they obviously get a moment to shine, because in that last battle, every single MCU hero gets at least a moment.
Yeah.
And that, again, I don't know how they were able to pull it off in Infinity War, and I don't know how they were able to pull it off again with Endgame, but it was a masterpiece. In yeah. terms of a master class. How about that? A master class.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's and we're going to break down that battle in as much detail as we can, because it's literally the thing that continues to stick in my head. I mean, you come off of Infinity War, where you have multiple amazing battle set pieces. And then, you know, like that whole thing is basically just a battle reel in Infinity War. And then you come into this one, and, you know, I love that we get, and, you know, I talked about this in our Get Hyped episode, and I talked about it, I feel like, ever since I saw Infinity War, that I was hoping that this film would do what it did, which was let a lot of time pass. Let the Avengers have to live with this failure and with this loss to Thanos. And let's just start right at the opening, though, because I gotta say, you know, of all the directions I thought they would take it in to get us to that time span, killing Thanos at the beginning was not a direction I thought it was gonna go in. And that was an amazing opening. I mean, like everything, you know, from the opening on, especially, I mean, like Tony getting rescued by Carol and then them just going off and finding Thanos and finding out that the reason that he used the stones was to destroy the stones. And then you just have to live with that. Like, I thought that that was a genius stroke at the beginning of this. What did you guys think of this? Like, I guess it's like the first 15 minutes of this movie where we find Thanos and then zoop, he went for the head.
You mean the yeah. trailer?
Yeah, exactly. The trailer. No, I mean, we talked about it a lot on the network. You're right. Like how the Russo said, they're only allowing the first 15 minutes of the film to be used for footage. And they really kind of did. I mean, a few shots from the end battle here or there. But man, oh, man, oh, man. Like, so what do you guys think of this opening with Thanos' death at the very beginning?
It took something that could have been very predictable and just flipped it on its head.
Yeah.
So that was very impressive. And like you said, doing the 5 years later thing and seeing where all of our heroes have dispersed to just gives it so much more of a weight. And that was one of my biggest problems with Infinity War, because I rolled out of the theater thinking, okay, well, and 5 minutes later, everybody's going to be back. Well, it wasn't 5 minutes into the movie. It wasn't even an hour into the movie. So there was some real heft to what they had to deal with there emotionally, both among the heroes and the general population too.
Yeah.
I stopped into the Disney store in Chicago this weekend, and they had all the merch, which actually they didn't have too much. I was pretty disappointed, but they had all the merch, and all the merch had the ones who survived. And so I walked up to the lady at the cash register, and I was like, so do you have the other merch in the back that is going to be, you know, usable about half an hour into the film. So the fact that they wait until the last 20 minutes of the film to bring them all back, I'm still waiting for that wave of toys to come out in about a week when we get the Spider-Man in-game.
Uh-oh. Well, I think we lost. What? Oh, I think we lost you there for a second. The last thing we heard was Spider-Man Endgame toy. So,
oh no, I'm still here.
Okay, keep going, man.
I think it's just you.
What,
you're crazy.
I'm crazy? No, I'm not. Did Thanos get you, man? Come on.
It's that Cardinal's head. It's constricting your head.
Well, that's entirely possible. And you know what I also loved about that is like. And I heard that this was a lot more of a reaction in the theater we were in, like all across the country. But the way that they do 5 years later so slowly in that title card, I mean, like each word coming up one at a time there and taking their time with it. I really just appreciate that from a filmmaking standpoint.
It's kind of like Gamora kicking you in the nuts twice.
Yeah, you get them the second time. But that gives us something that we haven't seen with these Avengers before, which is them not only, I mean, we've seen them, you know, not be successful, then ultimately be successful. We've seen them fail a few times, but not like an ultimate, the end of the world type of failure. I love that we have to see how each of these characters has to deal with that, with knowing what they've lost and that they can't do anything about it, even with all the power that they have. Steve Rogers' instinct is to help people, to run support groups and to try and help people get through it, which I love that scene, by the way. I thought that that was going to be the scene that was going to be my like one thing. I was like, oh, I could cut that out. But as I look back on it, I love that support group scene. But you don't
like character scenes?
No, I love character scenes. I was just thinking like, oh, you know, we want action. But then they actually really get that as part of like what they were doing with that first hour of the movie. And you know how Natasha can't deal with it at all. You know how she has to try and find ways to find some conflict to try and manage and such. So I really, really appreciated that we had to see these.
Since you mentioned Natasha trying to figure things out for herself, I'm going to say it now because there's a lot of fanboy theories out there already. Much like sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, sometimes an earthquake is just an earthquake. Chill the flock out.
You might not be – you couldn't be thinking about a certain Namor theory now.
That is so stupid. It's not even funny.
Very true. Very true. I'm right there with you on that. Was there any of the arcs – so obviously our main six are – you know, the big crux of the beginning of this film and how they had to deal with this. Obviously, we see Hawkeye lose his family at the very beginning of this movie, which, by the way, I predicted about 1,500 times last year. But was there any of these six that you really gravitated towards when it came down? Oh, come on. Don't get caught up on one phrase.
Come on. Ronan shows up in this movie. We knew in the trailers, but you assumed his family was going to be, you know, peachy keen.
No, I said that they would start the movie with that scene.
Oh, okay.
That's specifically what I said.
If you thought his kids were going to make it.
I didn't predict that Hawkeye's family was going to die. That was my big prediction. No, I thought that the best way to start the movie would be with that. Gotcha. To remind us of the stakes, and I was glad that I was right about that. Anyway, back to the question, though, the two of you. Was there any one particular character that you resonated with their aftermath story more?
Well, Thor was relatable as all get out.
In more ways than one, right?
Yeah. I'm relating with him right now.
I do feel like melted ice cream.
Hey, Jeremy.
Yes.
Hey, Jeremy.
What?
This is Craig. I'm on your left.
Craig McFarlane on the left, everyone.
Yeah. Craig doesn't know what live is.
Anyway.
No, man. I was just giving you one of my favorite moments of the film. That's all.
That's true. On your left. We're going to get to that battle. Steve, anything else you want to say about Fat Thor there?
Like I said, hashtag relatable.
Related is which one was your favorite? Which of those six was your favorite?
In all seriousness, I loved Chris Hemsworth in that role. I mean, he's flipped back and forth between absurd comedy and just some really heavy emotional moments, and he played it beautifully.
Yeah, absolutely. That whole Thor sequence is, and I think you're right. Hemsworth's whole journey throughout this movie is very, very interesting, especially like he's clearly traumatized so much by the snap and by failing to kill Thanos, you know, in Infinity War. And I love that that manifests itself in many different ways. And you're right. You're like in the midst of that comedy that is so hilarious and that you're just letting Hemsworth do what he does best there. The fact that they do then all of a sudden just on a dime turn that to like almost a PTSD type situation of just hearing Thanos's name and on and like just being triggered of emotion like that. I just thought that that was a really, really great thing there. Scott, what about you? Do you have any of these six that hit you the most?
Can you guess?
Yes, I'm going to guess, but I mean, you can say for the audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, Cap's story is the best story out of this entire film. It's kind of a given with the Russos guiding the ship from Winter Soldier up until now. So that makes sense. But also just his narrative, I really do appreciate the fact that he is trying to make things right by helping others. Even when later on we get a scene with him and Nat saying, it's not working for me. I'm not going to be right. Even though I'm trying to help others, I cannot handle this. So I did appreciate that quite a bit. And just the interactions between him and Stark, where Stark, who was completely wrong, but whatever, going off on him saying that you lied to me, we weren't together, whine, 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 cry, cry, cry. It's not my fault that we, you know, broke up, but now it's your fault that we weren't here together. So dealing with all of that was great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Cap storyline is, obviously, it's the thing that ends this movie. You know, it's our last shot of this film. I agree with you that I think that seeing Cap like have more of an edge in this movie too was kind of great. You know, not any kind of like jerkish streak, but I feel like he is still shaken to the core by the snap and the sense that, you know, that scene with Natasha specifically in Avengers HQ, you know, talking about moving on and what he tells others and how he knows he can't. You know, it's like Steve has that profound loss, but he's also still, of course, Steve. He still wants to do anything that can happen there. And you're right, like his interactions with Tony are fantastic in this, you know, that first meeting as well. Craig, what about you? What each of these six really got to you?
It would be awesome if you could repeat the question for the guy to join me the hangout late.
I thought you might pick up on it, but I'll give it to you again, man. We're talking about how like the aftermath of the snap and the way the original six Avengers deal with it is a big crux of the first hour of this movie. And so we just were wondering which ones stood out to you the most and which ones resonated with you the most.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, obviously Cap and Nat, I like that they both try to keep everything together, at least some semblance of the Avengers moving forward, and I appreciate that. I think the second time I watched this movie, I appreciated Stark's point of view a bit more than I did the first time. The first time, because he was just so whiny coming, and also he lost an awful lot of weight for being 3 weeks in space. he must not have had a lot of meat on his bones to begin with, but, you know, he... It's a redemption story for Tony, obviously, and obviously he makes that final sacrifice. But I do like that there's a bit of a there's a bit of a dichotomy between him and Cap that continues on into this movie, where Cap is always going to be the optimist and Tony's always going to be the pessimist until maybe the very end when he finally does sacrifice himself. So I enjoyed Stark's arc through this whole thing, and obviously he, next to Cap, is the lead of this movie, so he carries it well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, I saw a time chart broken down for this film, and I think like Steve and Tony had the most time, screen time devoted to
Steve them. Had more.
Steve did have more, I think, by like four or five minutes. Yeah. But you mentioned it there, Scott or Craig. So let's jump into it a little bit, because I want to save Steve for the end, since he does end this movie. Tony's story in this is quite a journey. And you know, I don't know why. Look, it's not like that Iron Man being the final sacrifice, being the death, the big death in the movie. It's not like that's a shocking proposal, but like the fact, I think it's because we see him finally move on from the Iron Man persona in those 5 years and have a daughter and, you know, have that thing to live for that you don't necessarily need to go back. You can move forward with it. I think that was something that really kind of hit me with it, that, you know, like it never occurred to me that Tony wouldn't want to try to make things right, you know? And I know ultimately he does, and his curiosity and his science side wins out. But I thought that Downey's performance in this movie is even more a step up as Tony Stark than what we've seen him in the previous films. You know, if there wasn't such a bias, I would say he would be one of my dark horses for an Oscar nomination, because he does amazing work in this film, and he has for the past decade. But and you know, hey, half of the job of getting an Oscar nomination is somebody mentioning it. So I'll mention it right now. But so what a little bit more, like, Steve, talk a little bit more about Tony and what you saw from him in this movie.
Well, first of all, I got to double back. I saw Scott's face when you started proposing Robert Downey for the Best Actor Oscar. I don't know if that's going to happen. But
I was giving him a squint eye.
Yeah, yeah.
He got nominated for Tropic Thunder. I think we can get some Avengers Endgame love.
Well, honestly, this would be one that I would think the whole cast should get the ensemble. Is that the SAG Awards?
Yeah.
The best cast?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Tony with the cabin in the woods and the daughter and Pepper and all that sort of thing. There's something about it. I'm kind of grasping, as you can tell. But it almost seemed a little too pat, if I'm really being overcritical about it. But again, it's one of those things, in hindsight, you could see them setting up for him having to give up this life he's always pursued.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, I'm the one who's argued from day one that Tony has never had growth. And I still don't think he's had much growth in this. He is still, I mean, even his dad points out, I forgot the actual line fully, but the whole idea that his narcissism seldom leads to selfless acts. And I know I've mentioned this to you guys after we watched the movie, and you all thought I was crazy, but the fact that he keeps saying I'm Iron Man and not that I'm something else, again, shows me he has not grown the entire time. That's why I can't get behind him as a character.
I don't buy that in that scenario, man. Honestly,
of course you don't, because you're biased towards him and I'm not.
No, I'm more biased towards Cap personally, but I think that I just think, like, the bookend, the reason the MCU exists is because Downey stands at the podium and says, I am Iron Man. So it's that being his final line.
But,
I mean,
but
I
how
guess
is
if you
that,
want to say Pepper, but
how,
like,
but how is,
know,
that growth? How is the character growth?
No, the growth comes from his very first. And again, this is why it makes sense for Steve and Tony to be the main crux of this movie, as they were the entire MCU so far, because their very first, like, one of their most known interactions in the first Avengers movie was that interaction where the Scepter's kind of playing with their minds, and Cap looks at him and says, "Always a way out. You're not the guy to make the sacrifice play to lay on the wire so somebody else can climb over it." And now you see Tony doing that, making
that. But he did that in
choice.
The same movie. That was foreshadowing for that movie.
No, it's foreshadowing for the whole thing, because then Tony has
nuke.
To continue. Tony's growth arc through the entire MCU is the most, pardon the pun, Stark of any character, all right?
Nah.
Like, if we want to compare it to Captain America here, who grows all of this much in the entire franchise, I mean, like, Cap's who he is the whole time, and that is what his character needs to be. And that's a great character. He needs to be that steady, that constant that everybody is measuring.
You're right.
Against.
You're right. And completely going against his country several times, he didn't, you know, change at all. You're
what
right
are you talking about He destroyed Hydra. Whatever. If you're talking about the Sokovia,
he was against S.H.I.E.L.D. from the beginning. Even before we knew it was Hydra, he was talking about how Craig's rolling his eyes at me. But the whole idea is,
I just don't understand. No, you could think that Tony doesn't have a growth arc at all in the entirety of the MCU, or at least in this film.
But everything you've told me about his growth happened in Avengers 1.
It's happened the whole time, man.
But that's not growth. That's stagnation.
Yes, it is. No, it's not. He's the most dynamically changing character of the entire MCU.
Because if you think about going into Iron Man 3 and the PTSD, and then that carrying over into particularly Civil War, but also Age of Ultron. I mean, he makes Ultron basically to try to make this defense mechanism, right, which blows up in their face. And then into Civil War, which gives us the Sokovia Accords and all that. That was the through line. I mean, it changed because he did try to make that ultimate sacrifice, and it traumatized him to such an extent that it completely changed him as a character, and his motivations changed in that moment. And I mean, obviously I'm a Captain America fan, but I think you get both stories so well told. You get so many well told stories in Endgame, but the character that Robert Downey Jr. plays is really great, really, really great portrayal of this tertiary character that not a lot of people knew about or cared about before the MCU became a thing. And here he is putting his life on the line at the end. And I really got emotional, even more emotional, I think, the second time that I saw it, just because the way that it was done was great. I mean, you did see it coming from a mile away as soon as it ended up being those last two on the field, but it still just, it hit me hard. And I love the last line. I love the, because again, that decision to go out and tell the world who he was, that he wasn't going to hide behind a mask, is what really started this whole journey for us. It's what brought from Iron Man all the way through Endgame. And I can appreciate that as a huge Captain America fan. I think Steve's had a lot of growth in this. I think a lot of people try to say that, you know, particularly Lou, he's not on this podcast, but he argues every day that Cap had no growth in this entire franchise. I think that's not accurate. And I truly think that Iron Man, saying Iron Man had no growth is also a not accurate thing. And it's not really necessarily, that discussion is not necessarily relevant to my absolute joy and love.
Jeremy started it.
This movie of Endgame. Obviously superhero movies are the black sheep of the Oscars, and they're not going to be nominated for a lot here. My argument would be more for Marcus and McFeely getting an adapted screenplay nomination because of the insane things that they did for not only Infinity War, but also for this.
This is a discussion for another day, but yeah, I mean, the fact that comic book movies in general don't get adapted screenplay nominations at all.
I think Logan did, but that was basically it
I know of.
And that was forced. I mean, that was really there was a huge push by Fox for that. But I think that there needs to be some kind of commemorative or maybe even a special Oscar. You know, they gave Walt Disney a special Oscar for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, right? Why can't they give Kevin Feige, I don't know, 22 mini Oscars all shaped like Thanos or something for this insane creation that he had? Yeah.
Thanks for the $25 billion in revenue you've given us over the years.
They're just going to nominate more indie films.
They should find some way to honor that man. And of course, all the people that have built these films going forward. But I've taken us really off track. My apologies.
No, Jeremy,
we all have.
this film, to steer it back on, it's incredible how they tied this all up into a bow and really gave a lot of the fans a lot of satisfying endings. And people could argue, probably correctly, that there's a ton of fan service in this. But you know what?
Somebody did.
Craig was late to the party.
Yeah, I know.
We've had 22 movies. And what I want is fan service. I am a fan, and I want to be serviced. And this movie serviced me well.
Okay. Well, what meme that, you at again? Out there. No, but you actually make a good point, like Steve and you, and I, Scott, you touched on it too, though. Fan service doesn't necessarily mean bad things here, all right? It gets a bad rap because usually when it's done to the detriment of good storytelling. Mm-hmm. This is fan service as good storytelling because they set up these beats. They set up all of these things that we want to see, and they make sense in this movie.
Well, and here's where it works. The reason why it works in this film, and it works throughout the MCU for the most part, is the people making these films care about the source material.
Yeah, they're the fans.
Other large franchises that I will not mention, it's clear that the people making the films don't care about the source material. So they're like, oh, the fans want to see this, so we'll just throw it in there. And it's tacked on. Mm-hmm. Whereas in with these films, it is fluid and makes sense because they care about it as much as we do.
Yeah. And I also love that they like bring back like things that I didn't even know that I wanted to see, like Cap wielding Mjolnir. Like, that was obviously, once it happened, I was just like, oh crap, yeah, of course I wanted to see that since Age of Ultron. Like, and you know, like, it just kept bringing back all these things, especially in the battle at decimated Avengers HQ. But we've been talking here for about 30 minutes and we haven't even mentioned
about nothing.
We haven't even mentioned the time travel aspect of this movie.
Yes.
And it seems to be the most contentious part of the reviews of this movie, whether or not people like how they deal with time travel. And I gotta say, personally, I really like it, and I think it makes a lot more sense. And you know, one of the people who are way smarter than me on here, which I think is all three of you, correct me if I'm wrong here, but essentially what they're arguing here is that movies like Back to the Future and such have said that when you travel back in time, you change one little thing, butterfly effect, bam, bam, and it can affect literally everything in the future. And one little thing can affect everything. It's what the Sound of Thunder theory. But in this movie, it's saying, like, if you change something in the past, you interact with yourself, whatever, you don't necessarily change the entirety of every future. You just kind of create a new future, a new offshoot of a time parallel. Is that about what they're treating this like?
I do love the fact that they make fun of Back to the Future, but that is Back to the Future too.
Yeah.
It's all, actually, it's really done better by the JJ Universe Star Trek.
Yeah.
2009. The whole idea of, you can't change your timeline because your timeline is your past.
Right.
But when you go back and you change something, it becomes a different universe that has to follow a different path.
Right.
And
but the other universe still continues on, but just, you know, absent what you removed.
No, that's the whole point. You didn't remove it in the original universe because you can't.
Right.
Because if you removed in the original universe, your universe no longer exists, which means you would no longer exist, which makes a paradox.
Right, which actually makes it so that this movie doesn't have to obey these, we can't meet up with ourselves, we can't interact with ourselves, and oh, what happens if this, what happens if that?
Well, and it's why you can pluck Thanos to 2014, but still have Thanos in Infinity War, because it's two separate universes.
Right.
Or maybe the best example of it, Nebula killing herself.
Exactly.
Not immediately disappearing a la Back to
Marty
the Future.
McFly style.
Yeah, they're basically getting rid of the grandfather paradox. It doesn't exist in this film.
Right. And do you all like how they dealt with that then? Because some reviewers have not.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, for me, time travel is like sex and pizza. Even a bad even when it's bad,
at the same time,
good. Well, I mean,
at the same time, sure.
If that's the way you roll,
I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah, I love time travel stories. Give it to me, you know, in whatever form. And I thought it was great. I loved Cap fighting himself. I loved that the Russos did the time honored tradition of having the original Cap keep his hood, his headpiece on, so we could tell them apart. That's like classic doubles problem.
Yeah. Nebula's racing stripe is the same idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't have any problem with it.
Before I, Craig, you had a point, but just real quick. I like time travel as long as they define their own rules, because and Hulk says it best. Time travel is either fully a joke or fully not. And if you don't define your own rules in whatever story you're making, you can completely run off the rails. But as long as you define your rules and you stick with them, there, I mean, time travel at this point doesn't exist. So you can make up any rules you want about it. And they held to them. So it worked.
Right. And they took the time to spell those out for us so that, you know, we could answer these questions. Craig, what were you going to say?
Well, just that, I mean, it is still a bit confusing to me. So, for instance, and let me throw this out to you guys, is Cap still frozen in the ice when he goes back, or because he had woken up and had these experiences that Captain America is not in the past? That's the thing I'm confused about.
I don't think they ever went back far enough to when he wasn't woken up.
Oh, yeah, when he went back to Peggy and had the dance. Yeah. I mean, he lived his whole life.
There are two Caps. It's much the same way that there are two of everybody in the Battle of New York. So technically, old Steve Rogers was around when, you know, 30-year-old Steve Rogers woke up in 2012. And he was just waiting for – he was taking the long way around, to use Doctor Who, to get to back to where he was. So you have two Caps.
The other big complaint I have is that we didn't see the darkest timeline, because we saw just about every community actor possible in this movie. The Russos were like, yeah, come on in, be in our sandbox. Come on in, community. The only one that didn't make it in, I guess we didn't see Donald Glover and we didn't see Joel McHale, but it would have been great to see the darkest timeline and see what the ancient one was talking about when he said that it was going to turn everything to hell.
Well, what she was talking about, because in the first viewing, I was like, I don't know what she's talking about. But in the second viewing, it's pretty clear. She's talking about Doctor Strange, the movie Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
She's saying, if you take away the time stone now, millions will die because Doctor Strange will not have the time stone to stop Armageddon in his film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then that's where we get the crux of what the time travel rules are in this movie, because Banner tells her, like, no, that's not exactly how this works. You know, like, if we remove the stone here, this keeps going, but it just creates an offshoot. So, like, I think that was...
Yeah, but what she's saying is her offshoot is going to be terrible.
Right.
Because they're all going to die.
Yeah, exactly.
The other scene I really want to see is I want to see Steve returning the Soul Stone to Red Skull.
To Vormir.
Because I really want to know what went down when he returned that Soul Stone.
He releases the people who were put in the Soul Stone? Question mark?
Perchance.
Yeah, perchance.
Because if you want to keep saying those two are dead, feel free, but they're not, so...
Yeah. Well, so we talked a little bit now. It sounds like we're all cool with how they treated time travel in this. So let's get into the crux of the heist as well. I really like the sort of Italian Job aspect to this movie, where they're planning the heist itself. Some great comedy that gets to take place there, especially from Fat Thor, you know, trying to explain the Aether to everyone. That's just every time they let Hemsworth be Hemsworth and just be funny is just the best times in the MCU to me. But I just liked how it all had to come together and they all started realizing it. And then the execution of this, like, as a capstone film on the MCU as we know it, and being able to take us back to some of those amazing moments that we've seen before. You know, it's kind of what I figured would happen when, you know, we started getting reports of quantum realm suits and time travel whispers. But the execution of it was perfect. I mean, even if just like just one scene that really stuck out to me, like when they did the Avengers, when they were all up in the tower cornering Loki at the end of that movie, and it, like, they could turn away and Stark says something like, you know, like, oh, come on, we can just keep posing up here, or we can get to work or something. Like, I just love that, because you get that really awesome shot at the end of Avengers, but you're like, yeah, what the hell happens after that? And then they answer that question there. I just think the way that they dealt with all of these characters going back to pivotal moments in their movies, I thought was just expertly done. That was my favorite. Do any of those stick out to you guys, like, that you want to mention here?
The traveling back?
Yeah, like just
absolutely loved because to this day I love the opening of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume One.
Yes.
And so to see the other side of that, you know, like to see Chris Pratt singing that song on his own, and
but not hearing the music. Yeah,
it's also really funny that like how the word idiot was used throughout this entire film, because it's almost like. Nebula caught on, like Nebula and Rhodey call people idiots like 6 times in this movie. And it's something that I noticed throughout, and it's really interesting. I kind of want to go back and see if Rhodey in particular called a lot of people idiots before, but it's just a really funny, I don't know, dichotomy that developed between Nebula and Rhodey in particular. But it's just so funny to see that scene from the other side, like from somebody else's point of view, because that really establishes Star-Lord as kind of this cool guy in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
And it just is completely destroyed.
Like, yeah.
And obviously we've gotten more about Star-Lord, so we know that he's not necessarily a cool guy. He's one of us. He's a nerd that turns into a superhero or gets abducted by aliens, essentially. But it's really cool to see that from the other point of view. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, that was a really funny moment. Steve, any stick out to you?
What was the question?
You already mentioned Cap. Cap fighting himself was pretty great, but
America's ass.
America's ass.
I know what I was going to say. I was reminded, I mean, we've talked about the Back to the Future connection. I was reminded of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure towards the end, where they kept running around circles around themselves and, let me remember to duck, you know, and all that.
Yeah,
sort of
yeah.
Thing. It kind of reminded me of that a little bit, and I was okay with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, what about you?
Well, all of them had their fun moments. But 2012 New York has so much great stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The bait and switch of the elevator scene.
Yeah.
Because when he's walking the elevator, everyone, at least I was assuming, we're going to get another fight scene. But the fact that he can't have another fight scene because it's going to draw attention to himself, how does he get out of that room? And I also like the fact because to this day, the Hail Hydra line in the comics is my most hated comic book, I think, ever. That storyline, I mean, not that I read a lot of comics anyway anymore, but that storyline ruined a lot of comics for me just because that was freaking stupid. But the fact that they used it and used it well here was great. And that's just one example, but throughout that 2012 was really fun to watch. And then New Jersey 1970, same idea. There's a lot of great interactions there and a lot of fan service again. I mean, but there's a lot going on. In 1970.
Yeah, New Jersey didn't happen the way – I mean, like, you know, I guess I could have figured, like, oh, you know, they got to meet up and stuff. But the way they executed that conversation between Tony and Howard was, mm-hmm. I thought, just really good. You know, because when he sees him, I think it's going to be, like, the suspicious thing, oh, he has to, like, evade his father type thing, you know.
I mean, Steve mentioned Back to the Future. I think we've all mentioned Back to the Future. I was – when they showed up, I was like the Doc Brown scene in Back to the Future too.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, hand me the 3/4. Oh, don't you mean 5/8? That was going to be like that.
Yeah. No, but it turned insanely sweet. And I mean, like, you think about the arc of Tony's relationship or the way he thinks about his father throughout the MCU has been probably one of the most biggest points of change for him. You know, like thinking that he, no, seriously, like you think, like Iron Man 1, it doesn't come up a ton, but in Iron Man 2, it's definitely a big part of it where we learn that he really doesn't like his dad. He was convinced his dad didn't like him. And, you know, Nick throws a bomb in that. And then, you know, the more he learns about him, and then this scene, especially with Civil War as well, with how he never got to say goodbye to his father, this serves as like a great goodbye to his father. And I just thought that he and John Slattery were doing really great work in this entire sequence.
Well, totally that was a theme. Go ahead, Craig.
Well, I was going to say, I totally agree with you. But Scott, go ahead and finish it up because I had another point about this.
Well, I was just going to say that was very thematic, the saying goodbye to people you didn't get to say goodbye to, because it also happens to Thor and his mother. Same idea, which, by the way, the fact that they use the worst well, the sec for me, second worst MCU film as a as a plot point, and actually did it well, was kind of funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Scott Lang's the only one who cares about that story.
Yeah, that was great. He's so excited about that. Steve, did you have something you were going to say?
It was Craig.
Yeah, it was Craig.
Oh, Craig, go ahead.
Well, I would just say the only thing I would say in Jersey is that when Shirley tells the guards to that these guys are coming down and that they need to go get them, there's really no payoff to that, because like then Tony and his dad hug it out, and Steve is kind of off in the corner, sort of like, hey, we got to get going. But there's no, I wonder if there's a deleted scene there. And I know that her name's not Shirley. I'm referring to her by
the actress Yvette name. Nicole Brown. Those are yes. You're talking
about. But anyway, so I wonder if there's like a deleted scene there, just because like it seemed like they had no sense of hurriedness throughout that scene. So I almost would have maybe cut that with her walking down the hallway with the guards.
Yeah,
because it ended up not getting paid off at all, and so
actually, to me, I can see
it was a
there.
Little bit odd that scene.
I think that was just there to build that tension. What you're looking for is that tension of them having to move quickly, and but they do, because even at the end when he's tugging his dad, Steve's in the background telling him, okay, well, do you have what we need? Let's get going.
Yeah, and also don't forget, I think the first time we see her doing that with the guards is when Steve is walking down the hall and then he has to duck into Peggy's office.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're right.
Perhaps, you know, you could maybe spin that to where Steve would want very much to talk with her or to, you know, say something to her in that time, but knows that he can't, that he's short on time and he has to get back. They've got a mission to do. It's a stretch, but you know, like,
I guess that is true. You're right. That is, they do duck into Peggy's office in that moment. So maybe that's the payoff for that. But to me, it just seemed like a weird way to try to hurry the scene. And then I didn't think that it really had much of a payoff, because at the end, they're both just standing out there in plain sight. And there's there's no MP presence to be like, hey, we're after these guys or whatever. And it just seemed like one of those times where when someone dies in a film and they get to say a whole monologue before they actually die, it was like these two are on the run from the MPs potentially. And you get an entire scene between Howard Stark and Howard Potts that it's just, to me, it was a little bit off-putting is all.
Yeah. Okay. I can hear you there. And I will just say the only other thing on New Jersey 1970, man, this de-aging technology that Disney is using, Michael Douglas. I mean, look, wig aside.
Oh my gosh.
But the way.
They could have done better on the wig though.
Yes.
The wig
but
was
like,
bad.
The face is just ridiculous how they do this. And that uncanny valley is disappearing even more and more every single time Marvel makes a movie, dude.
But I've watched this twice now, and both times I got a trailer for Gemini Man. It seems that Marvel's the only one who can do it right.
Right.
Because it is creepy as Will Smith the age. That doesn't work at all.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with you there. Obviously another offshoot that came out of this though is, and Scott, you mentioned this to me in just our talking about it, but yeah, like one of the consequences, Loki is now somewhere because he takes that space stone from 2012. He's gone.
Well, and not only that, I mean, the space stone is now missing. Mm-hmm. From that timeline. So the goal of fixing that timeline for the ancient one didn't happen because they replaced the 1970 space stone, but they did not replace the 2012 space stone,
which they definitely
needed. So that timeline is still screwed.
Yeah.
And I have confirmed sources that space stone exists solely on Disney Plus. So
exactly.
You can find out exactly where Loki went on Disney Plus starting November 12th of 2019 for only $6.99 a month.
I've mentioned this before, but the way they describe the Loki show is a Doctor Who show with Loki, and I'm looking so forward to it.
Yeah.
He just bounces around time causing mischief.
Also, Craig, how much stock did Disney give you more? How much more stock did Disney give you to make that little announcement?
I will tell you what. I looked for the first time the other day. I don't own much stock in Disney, but I do own stock. I own like maybe 30 shares. And when I bought, it was like $95 a share. And now it's $148 a share or something like that. I was like, keep making these movies.
Buddy. I think it's about to go up again, man.
Galaxy's Edge
might have some kind of impact on that, I bet. But you can hear all about that on Beyond the Mouse.
Look at this, plugging away. All right, well, you know, we get this time travel, these heists. If there's anything else anybody wants to mention, I actually really liked I've seen some complaints online about how Vormir was treated in this movie and that maybe Natasha got the short end of the stick here when it comes to remembrances. I really like that it's Natasha that makes the sacrifice there on Vormir. I think it makes sense, you know, especially in light of her and Steve's conversation where she confesses, you know, I, you know, didn't have anything, but then I got this family and then it was taken away from me. You know, I just think it made sense. And I love the fake out of, you know, they've got Clint slow-mo running off that cliff. I mean, it looks like that's it. And I like how they bait and switch it there. And it makes more sense, I think, narratively. What did you guys think of the way Vormir was handled here?
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here because
okay.
According to the rules that they've set up, you have to sacrifice something else that you love. And if Natasha sacrifices herself...
Well, I think the wording, I think the wording that Skull uses there, or whatever his name is, I think the way the wording he says, you must lose that which you love, a soul for a soul. So I don't know if it necessarily needs to be like Thanos did with Gamora, where he actually throws her off. Yeah. I think that a sacrifice for the person that's still left standing there in some way.
Yeah, and you don't have to be family or lovers to love someone. And it is very clear from the beginning of Avengers 1 that Barton and Natasha have that relationship,
right.
A friendship that is love. So I don't see any problem at all of her being a loss to him.
Yeah, I think I think the logic makes sense. I think what a lot of people are talking about when I see these articles online is that Tony gets this giant funeral and Natasha gets a scene by the lake. And I mean,
because she'll be back.
And yeah, and that's what I always think too. And it's like I can kind of understand that, but at the same time, it's just like. The mission isn't over, you know, like you can't pause for too long here. You got to figure this stuff out.
Well, to go to Steve's point, I think the line, you know, going to Vormir and when Clint looks over and says, we've come a long way since Budapest. And that whole like callback to the first Avengers and them talking about that. And then really their breakup there where Clint decides to go off with his family. I do think it makes sense from Natasha's point of view. Clint went to this dark place where he started murdering essentially anyone that he feels has done any kind of wrong in the world because he feels like they don't deserve to live if his family can't. So to me, it makes a lot of sense that she would want to ultimately sacrifice herself.
And then there's the rules of Vormir too.
Right. The rules of Vormir are a little tricky to figure out. But the last thing I'll mention about Vormir is that it is really cool. If you look – I'm pretty sure if you look at Gamora and you look at Black Widow, they're mirror images of each other.
I think they are
laying
too.
On the ground. So, and then, which is just an interesting thing to do visually. So,
yeah.
But what? Speaking to Jeremy's comments about people online, I think what we're seeing a lot online is that the people. For the most part, this movie is getting high praise. And so in order to get those clicks out there, you have
mandatory
to have some
contrarian.
Kind of contrarian viewpoint. And so you have to say that, you know, for some reason, them bringing the A-Force together and showing us all these women is actually a bad thing.
That article was so off-base,
you know,
man.
Stuff like that, you know, it just – I think that there is some hint of contrarianism out there. Now, granted, should they have given two funerals? I don't know. Like, but Nat did die. They did acknowledge that death, and then they talked about that death even after Tony's funeral. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah. It's not like they just completely forgot her. They had this whole scene where they're talking about, oh, I just wish that there was a way that I could tell her this all worked out and that her sacrifice worked.
Yeah.
And then that brings Vision into it, because also Vision didn't get any kind of
That scene between Clint and Wanda was great.
Let's go back to Loki. Loki didn't get any kind, you know what I mean? Like, so it's not as if along the way when we've lost our heroes or even hero pseudo villains that we've just stopped and had a funeral. I think Tony Stark's funeral makes a lot of sense at the end of this, because like Scott said, he is the one that seems like he's permanently gone. The others possibly could come back. Now, no one dies in comic books. We know that, but it seems like Tony Stark is pretty well there.
Yeah.
And going two reasons for me why I think the Natalie sacrifice or Natasha sacrifice makes sense, and it's great for the character. Well, number three, she'll be back, but because a prequel is a stupid idea and it's not going to happen. Sorry. Yeah. Two is her whole point has been from beginning until now that she has not been in control of her own destiny. From when she was a kid onwards, other people made decisions for her.
Great point.
Even throughout these movies, she's been controlled more by the plot than by her choices she made. And this is one time where she got to make the choice. She got to decide for herself. Another piece is, again, going back to what her conversation with Banner and Ultron, which people had issues with that conversation that makes no sense, but because their issues weren't really issues. It was, again, contrarian. But the whole idea was she cannot have a family. She has this family. Whereas in she knows that Barton, if they pull this off, will get his family back.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have that.
How killer was it when Red Skull said Natasha, son of, or daughter of Ivan, and then
she says, like, I didn't know.
She's like, I didn't know who my dad was.
Yeah.
Well, and did you notice too that? Did you notice too that Barton's the only one, because he's always mentioned the patriarch. Mm-hmm. Barton's the only one where he mentioned his mother.
Yeah. Or yeah.
Because even with Gamora and with Thanos, it was the fathers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that sacrifice was very well warranted. I think that it was made logical sense. I honestly was not expecting to lose Natasha in this movie, so it came as a bit of a shock to me. And I wonder if they didn't know, you know, like when they were going, that's the one question I would want to have. They have this big powwow about how to get all of these stones and what happens with them. And I'm just wondering, like, did Nebula not tell them about the sacrificial aspect of Vormir, or did they think that they could find something else? I don't know. Or maybe, cause I mean, Nebula is the one who figures it out in Infinity War. You know, he went to Vormir with her. He didn't come back. Maybe she thought that he just killed her because, but so, I mean, that's the one question I have about this whole sequence. But
well, why would she tell them that, though? I mean, like, if you're Nebula and your thought is that you have to get these stones, I mean, I don't think that it's
callous. I think it makes the logical sense to say don't tell them because they won't do
it. Right, because if you're in that room in a modern timeline and you're talking about who's going, that where was it? Is it Ant-Man that says, is it Scott Lang that says, not me? Or who says not me when they talk about Boromir?
Something like that, yeah.
But,
not it.
But if you throw, yeah, not it. If you throw on top of that, oh, by BTW, you also have to kill somebody.
Somebody's going to be dying? Somebody. Yeah.
You know, then I think that it even becomes less of a mission that anybody wants to take on. But it is really interesting because listening to other reactions to this, I think we did kind of all forget, like collectively forget that Boromir requires a sacrifice to get the Soul Stone, because I didn't really think about it until I saw Red Skull there. And then I was like, oh my God, this is the same set of circumstances. This is going to take the same kind of thing. So I did think that Vormir is a really interesting place to take this story to for a second time.
Yeah, definitely. And I love the, like, you guys were calling out the original Avengers lines. If you remember in the first Avengers, how they get Natasha to come in, it's not the Tesseract's been stolen, it's Barton's been compromised. that's what gets her to abandon the mission she's on to come in. Yep. So I like, yeah, that relationship there is very strong, and very, very loving, friendship loving, as one of you said there. So yeah, obviously, you know, we get the stones, we're coming back and everything. We haven't even talked at all about, Professor Hulk here. This I think was the thing. I showed Sarah a picture of this and she was kind of creeped out by it. But I thought this was actually a really cool way to let Ruffalo kind of flex the Hulk muscles, so to speak, in this. And I really like that it's him that gets to do the snap to bring everyone back. And I'll tell you why. It's because, again, this movie is so good at calling back to everything we've seen so far in the universe, because he has a specific line he says before he puts the gauntlet on, which is, you know, it's mostly gamma radiation here. It's like I was meant to do this. And in the very first Avengers movie, when he and Tony are working in the lab, Tony posits to him that that amount of gamma radiation should have killed him. And so Bruce says to that, says like, okay, so you're saying that the Hulk kept me alive for some reason. That's a nice sentiment, but what? And Tony says to him, I guess we'll find out. Again, a direct line that I can draw to that, that is, this is Banner's destiny here to be the one to undo what Thanos did. So that's the way I took that too, but I love the what Ruffalo gets to do in this movie as well as Professor Hulk.
I'm not giving you looks, Jeremy. I'm giving Destiny looks, because Destiny is such a contrived idea that is false in so many ways. And
sure,
but
I think the line, I don't like the lines, idea of Destiny. I think the lines connect to each other very well in the first Avengers than in this one.
The only thing that I thought was weird about it was I was suddenly reminded of Beast. Here's the super powerful guy, you know, but oh, I'm also the cardigan wearing academic, and it's like, whoa, I remember Beast doing this. But yeah, Mark Ruffalo, he sold every single aspect of this character. So that was a wonderful thing to see him be able to play.
Well, and I think Kelsey Grammer did it better, Steve. But that being said, this is not new for the Hulk. It's new for MCU Hulk. But, I mean, we had Mr. Fix-It back in the 70s with Gray Hulk working in Vegas.
Wow, you just mentioned Mr. Fix-It. I freaking love you, Scott. Man.
You're welcome. See, I used to read comics. Greg reads comics now. I used to read comics.
Dude, wow. I never thought we'd ever get a Mr. Fix-It reference on any of our full disclosures.
I will say, this was the one that was most telegraphed because all the merch that was coming out showed Hulk wearing clothes, but also when you look at his face, it's more of a Ruffalo face than a hulked out face.
Yeah.
So it was kind of clear that this was going to happen, but I still like the way they did it. And I like the fact that it is again, a good transition for that character. And the idea that both of them had to come to terms with this in order for it to work. We don't get Hulk side as much, but it was made clear in the beginning when he's eating a lot of pancakes and eggs that Hulk had to be involved in this process as well for it to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting. You could like write psychology and philosophy books off of the reactions that the Avengers had to the snap, because obviously Steve is trying to be this grief counselor and Nat is going through stages of depression herself and all of that. Tony is a complete mess and just basically forgets about it, puts it aside. Really, truly, Hulk is the only person that moves forward. He's the only one that really looks for some kind of evolution, because he goes back to the lab and he starts, you know, he says 18 months of gamma ray treatments or whatever to be able to make him into this. And he seems to be like seemingly, I know it's a goofy scene in the restaurant where he's asking for selfies, but he is kind of somehow the optimist of this, or he seems like he's the one that is the happiest with the situation. Not that he's happy about the snap, obviously, but he seems to be moving on, and even to a point where kids are running up to him. So he's had adventures on his own where he is the good guy, or he's had some kind of
He's known. You're right.
We already know, yeah. We have Hunka Hunka Burning whatever Ben and Jerry's, but I'm sure there is a Hulk out cereal.
Hunka Hulka Burning Fudge, yeah.
Which he was eating, by the way, in this movie.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, well, look, we've been talking for an hour here. It's time. Let's get to the battle. I guess we'll call it the Battle of Avengers HQ Decimation. I don't know, man. Like the Battle of Upstate
New York.
Which
is so funny because we all thought in the trailer it was on a different planet.
I know, but I mean, like, you think about like how brilliant, again, the pacing of this movie is. The second we get this and we get some hope that this snap has worked and our friends are going to come back, everything blows up. And I mean,
I will give this kid credit. He may only be 6 years old, but Connor called it in our Get Hyped episode. He mentioned that in the trailer, you see, I think he said it was War Machine and Rocket sliding down Avengers HQ. And he's like, so I wonder if there's going to be a battle there. And in my mind, I was like, man, this kid needs to go to bed. But it was just really funny.
Connor also said that Hulk was Loki throughout the old movie. So
that's true.
Let's leave him at that.
We're not completely fully.
We love you, Connor.
Look, I don't know exactly if there's one aspect of this battle to break down specifically. I mean, like this is, as Scott has said many times throughout our existence here, the thing that we've been building towards. All of our heroes on the field at the same time, in truly epic sweeping shot of all of them preparing for battle with Thanos' forces. And I knew that Cap had to say Avengers Assemble in this, but man, oh man, like that was the best way I could possibly conceive of it happening, with that long shot ending right on his face saying it. That was the moment for me that just was the oh my god. But Craig, you mentioned On Your Left was also a great moment. There's so many good things about this battle. Rapid fire, anything you guys want to throw out here from the Battle of State New York?
All of the portals opening up.
Yeah.
And you start out thinking, oh, well, it'll just be a couple. And then the landscape is just littered with these portals. And it really, I love how there's been these iconic scenes that you would expect to see in a comic book throughout the series. The Civil War airport fight is a prime example. This one, where you've got winged horses flying and
Wakandan, you know, battleships, man.
It's just so evocative of a comic book, you know, cross panel or a cross page panel. It was just fantastic.
Well, and in my second viewing, it even hits you more because just the way they build to it. I mean, I was elbowing Jeremy during the first screening saying that it worked. We just don't know it's worked yet. I mean, because we saw the birds come back and everything else. So we knew it was going to happen. But the fact that Cap is at his last desperate moment, Thor is down, Iron Man is down, he's staring down the entire Thanos army.
Which that shot, dude, by the way, the second time I saw it, like there's so many great like wide landscape shots of
these
small Cap and all that. Like it's amazing, but keep going. I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
Thank you.
Yeah. But, I was thinking those shots like killed me the first time I saw him. I was like, wow. Like
the fact that the first thing he hears that he realizes there's still a chance is just Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And that builds to what we know at the end of the film now and what happens with Sam. But that connection to a fellow soldier in arms, somebody who has always had his back, who is, you know, somebody he was not expecting to hear on his intercom. Just that is a very profound moment that actually I felt more the second viewing because I had more time to take it in. But we now live in a world where Howard the Duck is an Avenger because he was there too.
By the way, people.
Yeah, I got to tell you, there were so many cool callbacks to the previous movies, and it really is like the writers just got into a room, really rewatched these movies, and wanted to have just little itty-bitty Easter eggs for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like T'Challa calling out Clint's name after he said he didn't care about him in Civil War, or things like Hope making fun of the fact that Scott is calling him Cap and she calls him Cap. Like, there's just like these little itty bitty moments that, in the grand scheme of things, you know, I keep reading these articles online that say, a critique of this movie is that you should probably have seen some of the other movies before it.
Well, duh.
Talk about the worst take ever. I can't believe those people get paid and we don't. But truly, the battle can be enjoyed by a casual viewer, someone that maybe only saw Infinity War in this. But it can truly be like savored by us fans, and call that fan service as you will. But just the little itty bitty things. And then even when we get the A-Force together and they say she's got backup, isn't that exactly what Natasha
Your Chatham says? Your Chatham internet is dying, Craig.
No, yeah, that's the what Natasha says in Infinity War is she's not alone. Yeah, that the because Proxima Midnight tells Scarlet Witch, you know, he'll die alone just like you. And Natasha says she's not alone. And then she and Okoye show up.
Yeah. It just, to me, like the little itty bitty one-liners really helped make this battle something very special.
Yeah, I agree with
seeing,
you.
Seeing all of our heroes at the same time, obviously. But just seeing the armies that they control and the massive universe that has been built around this this movie and this franchise, just absolutely mind-boggling.
Well, and again, I mentioned this at the start of it. This also serves every single person in the theater, because no matter who your favorite character has been, they get a moment. Mm. Everyone from Wasp all the way up gets a moment to shine in this.
Okay, this is where it's time for me to state my one and only semi-serious beef with the movie. I thought that Carol Danvers got completely wasted in this. For 90% of the movie, basically the only thing that she does is get Tony back with the rest of the group. And then she's off. And maybe it's because we're just coming off of such a great Captain Marvel introduction. I was hoping that she would be more involved than just at the setup in the first 15 minutes.
You know, Steve, I like what you're saying there, but I go back to something that Lou said in our Get Hyped episode, because I had always thought, you know, Captain Marvel changes the game. She's going to come and just beat Thanos up, and she could probably do it single-handed, and she nearly does in this movie. But we can't have this franchise that's been built over 10 years, 11 years, be saved by someone that we introduced 6 weeks ago. That's why I'm okay with her coming in. She still definitely saved the day multiple times, because she took down the ship. She obviously helped.
She kept him from snapping
down. Thanos. She kept him from snapping. I mean, there was a lot there. But I wanted to see our original heroes, the one that brought us to this point, be the ones that take us home, I guess.
When you have a character that's so overpowered, it would remove any kind of tension if she's there the whole time. Because we'd be asking, why didn't she, you know, stop this? Why didn't she do that? Why didn't she do this? So getting her off the field and doing it in a way that makes sense. There are thousands of planets I have to go save because you assholes can't fly around in space.
Yeah.
But every time she appears in this film, and she's my daughter's favorite now, she saw it today. Every time she appears in this film, it's a game changer. When she shows up to save Tony, it's a game changer. When she shows up to take out the battleship that's taking everyone down, changing it. When she is the one who grabs the gauntlet just right before the snap, she changes things. So, and she also saves Thor. Every time she shows up, she is a plot development that changes things. So I get that if you expected her to be there the whole time, that you're not going to get that. But she gets so much to do in the few minutes she's there that the narrative revolves around her.
Okay, I think I can accept that.
Yeah, and I'll give you this as well. Like, she gets some powerful moments. I mean, like, you know, Thanos headbutting her and her not even moving. Like, I mean, like, that was fantastic. I mean, like, not even budging an inch. I mean, like, it's more like, God, you really just tried that on me.
Well, and, I mean, that's fantastic. I love how they continue to change it up. The reason why Thanos beat Hulk in Infinity War is because Thanos used strategy, which is what the Russo brothers said. Same idea here. Okay, I can't take this girl out. I'm going to take the Power Stone off the gauntlet and use it itself. But my one concern with Brie Larson in this was I knew medically that she filmed these scenes before she filmed Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
So I was very concerned that we weren't going to see as an actress, her ability to handle, being at point B when she hasn't even acted point A. Mm-hmm. However, I felt that she had been through everything that happened in her movie, the way she interacted with Peter and the way she kind of was, you know, just kind of nonchalant and just less worried about what people think about her. Yeah. I felt that she had that. So I really appreciated that because it's something to tell an actress that, hey, we want you to film your sequel before we film your original.
Well, yeah. And again, it's just Brie Larson is so great at this. I mean, you're right. Like, I love the "Hey, Peter Parker" line. It's just, you're right. It's just so like casual and nonchalant in the middle of all this. But the thing that really calls out what you're talking about, Scott, is when she's there at the beginning looking at the screen of who's been lost and she sees Fury's picture and she is very emotional about it. The fact that you have that scene acted that way before you even had a shot, a frame with Fury in the other movie, that's what was fantastic to me.
I love the fact that no one is complaining, by the way, that the end scene for Captain Marvel didn't happen in this movie.
Yeah.
And why? No one is complaining about it. It's like, yeah, well, whatever. That's not how it happened. I'm like, okay. It was a deleted scene or what? I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah. You all are worried. You guys, let me get this straight. You were all worried about Academy Award winning actress Brie Larson being a good actress.
There is a difference between acting in one film where you, and it's a good film and she did a great job, where you're interacting with a few people in a room that has a full setting, to being on blue screen and being told to do things in an action scene. That's very different, and some people can handle one and not handle the other. Yeah. So I think Craig, I get what you're saying, but you're actually diminishing the fact that she pulled this off.
Yeah. And I'll admit, like, the seeing the female heroes all gather together to
put them through.
I thought that was really cool. And if for nothing else, it's just like, I kind of like, that was a powerful, powerful visual. You know,
I kept waiting for Sisters Are Doing It for Themselves to come on, you know, it was fantastic. And yeah. And those great visual moments.
Hindsight being 2020, we were actually got a spoiler of this in 2017.
Yeah,
because I can't remember who it was.
It was your favorite.
Okay, no, I don't think it was her. I think it was either Johansson or it was I can't remember, but it wasn't Paltrow because Paltrow's too stupid to talk. But they mentioned that we went to Feige and we asked him if we can get an all female Marvel film after they Avengers film they filmed. So hindsight being 2020, the reason why they said that was because they filmed that scene.
Yeah.
So yeah. Here's my tangent. I shared with these guys an article, maybe not Steve. I don't think he was on that particular message thread out of the millions that we have going on. But there was an article on Slate that the author argued that this was supposed to be the feminist moment of the movie, and that it fell flat because it seemed so contrived and so shoehorned in and put together. My reaction to that is that truly we have built these storylines for so many movies. If anything was contrived or thrown together, it was Pepper Potts being in this movie as a superhero. I mean, you get a little bit of that in Iron Man 3 and you get some foreshadowing at the beginning of this, but you don't necessarily expect for her to be there. But outside of that, every other character has been given so much so much gravitas to their characters. And that's why I don't like the argument. And I get that Ant-Man and the Wasp was the first time a female superhero's name was in the title, and Captain Marvel was the first standalone. But we have had such development of these female superheroes the entire time we've been in the MCU, and most of all in Black Widow, because again, go back and watch Winter Soldier, and she's nearly the star of that movie. Mm-hmm. It's almost nearly a Black Widow movie more than a Captain America movie. It's incredible that we get this shot. And I get that we're four dudes, that maybe are losing perspective here, but I think that that's important to show so many people too, that this is the world we've built and this is the playground we're playing in.
I don't think we're losing perspective, because anyone who says that this is the feminist moment didn't see the entire film. You have so many female characters making plot-centered decisions that change the way things go. I mean, obviously we've talked about Natasha. We didn't talk about Thor's mother, Rene Russo, and the fact that she's the one who turns him back around.
Yeah.
We talked about Carol Danvers. I mean, there's Valkyrie becoming the queen king. They actually call her the king of the Asgardians.
Of Asgard, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's so many moments. And the difference is, feminism isn't shoehorning something in. Feminism is allowing females to be equal to everyone else. And that is what happens in this film, because there's never one moment where you get the idea that the men are the ones leading the show, because a lot of times they're not. So I toss that argument aside, because it's somebody who wants, again, to get clicks and nothing more.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That article you're referencing really hit me the wrong way. It seemed like a pretty bad faith argument too, because it was like all you can, there was one line in it that really bugged me, which was all the female superheroes can ask for, or the female fans, is table scraps in a movie like this. I'm like, okay, so I don't know what you were expecting. What you needed more? I don't know, punch shots from the Wasp. I mean, what are you talking about here? A female saves this entire day here, like, well, she's the most powerful person on the field. Like, I don't get what we're talking about here.
Without Nebula, you don't win. Without Gamora, you don't win.
And that article completely negates Nebula's development in this movie. Like,
which Karen Gillan, who was a second tier in Guardians 1, because she was, and the fact that she is one of the actresses who was not really huge when they brought her on. She had Doctor Who, and that was about it. She has grown so much as a character in this film and as an actress. It's amazing.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. I'll just call out one more thing from this battle before we get into some final thoughts and such, is that Brolin, once again, doing excellent work as Thanos in this movie. Obviously a lot less to work with in this one, but man, I was very taken with, especially in this battle, how formidable of a fighting threat Thanos is. I mean, I know it kind of sounds weird to say considering how we first see him in Infinity War, but the prowess he has to, without any Infinity Stones at all, to take out Thor, Iron Man, and pretty much Captain America. I mean, I just love that we continue to see that this guy's a threat, even if he has no Infinity Stones, and he can be just as deadly to our heroes without them.
I may be the outlier here, but I thought Josh Brolin was so much better in this than Infinity War. And I have a lower opinion of Infinity War than a lot of people. I get that. But you didn't see, oh man, that's neat CGI or whatever. It's like, that's Brolin's Thanos. And it played completely realistically, as much as something like that can. But yeah, just fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else in the battle anyone who wants to call out real quick?
I never thought that they could make a battle that would stand above the airport scene, and they did.
They did.
Even in Infinity War. Infinity War had some great set pieces, but nothing was as impactful as the airport in Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
This is now the diamond standard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, this, we released that picture poll on our Facebook page, and it's pretty much useless now because there's one answer to what the best MCU battle is. So quickly here, like, let's talk about how this film wraps up and where it leaves us. Obviously, the funeral of Tony Stark is incredibly moving. I love that the Russos chose to do that one long take going over everyone.
Yes.
The music there, I think it was Alan Silvestri again in this film.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But there was actually pieces from each of those groups' films that played as they went. Yeah. That was the goodbye. to the phase, you know, the initial phases. That moment was the, here's where we have been.
Yeah, and I absolutely love that it ended with Fury. I mean, obviously it began with Fury, and that was just a great way. Because, I mean, in movie this stuff, like, you forget about things. You're just like, oh, yeah, Fury came back, and then there he is, and he has to, like, say goodbye to Tony, who he set on this path of, you know, forming the Avengers. And it's an amazing callback there. But one of you, I think it was you, Craig, that mentioned the scene with Wanda and Clint, or maybe that was you, Scott. I can't remember. But
it was me,
Craig. That's a great scene, because you're right, like, they call out the Vision isn't here anymore, still isn't here anymore. You know, and the fact that the two of them, and plus you remember those two had such a big moment in Age of Ultron, connecting to each other in the midst of the Battle of Sokovia. More
still comments. Still one of my favorite scenes in the MCU. If you walk out that door, you're an Avenger.
You're an Avenger. Yeah, it's like I'm on a floating city and fighting robots, and I got bows and arrows. You know, like amazing callbacks there. But obviously, we also get fallout that Thor is now looking like a Guardian of the Galaxy, which excites me to know.
Perfect.
In that movie.
Perfect.
You know, in the midst of all of our sadness, we get to see the Chrises dueling each other for captainship. It's just. It's an amazing scene there. But Scott, I know you had a theory about where that's heading. So let's just start there. So the Guardians obviously are teaming up with Thor here. You think we're going on a search for Spock scenario for Gamora?
The map he's looking at is trying to find Gamora. The question is he looking for 2014 Gamora or 2023 Gamora?
Well, because we don't know.
Here's the thing. I think it's changed. And this is nothing to do with the plot, but Guardians 3 was supposed to be the next film after Spider-Man, okay? Mm-hmm. And I could have easily seen this jumping off point to where the whole point of Guardians 3 is getting Gamora back. And in doing so, you would also get Black Widow back, because they're both in the Soul Stone, which is, I still say, where they are. And that would allow you to move into a Black Widow movie, which was already confirmed, but was not going to be the next one. Now it's probably going to be the next one in 2020. So I think they're having to rejigger the plan here because of that, because of having Guardians of the Galaxy probably not coming out until 2021, 2022 now, probably 2022. So I don't know how they're going to do it now, but I still think that it will be getting Gamora back. Will be the main cusp of the plot? I don't know. But if you didn't look at the fact that he was looking at a map, looking for her, and you don't think that's what he's going to be doing – until he finds her, then I don't know. You're not paying attention.
Well, yeah, because that jarred me about the funeral scene. Was like, oh, the Guardians are there, but where's Gamora? So did she get snapped out with the rest of what Thanos brought with him from 2012? Is he going after dead Gamora as Thanos killed her?
I can go both ways, because from what we've been told, the snapper gets to decide what happens.
Yeah.
And I don't think we ever had a scene where Tony even knew that Gamora was helping.
Exactly.
So I think if he just said, get rid of all of Thanos' people, Gamora is gone.
Yeah.
The 2014 one. Now, if there was a way of him knowing that she was helping, then she's probably still there.
But I don't think Tony's ever met Gamora anyway, so he wouldn't even know what she looks like, even so. All he knows is that Drax asks,
why is Gamora?
So,
yes.
I think that is a Guardians 3 with Thor alongside. Just sign me up a million times. I think that would be so much fun.
And Adam Warlock, I don't know if you've heard the rumors casting news, but Zac Efron as Adam Warlock, it'd be an interesting take for sure. But I imagine that would be more of a tertiary side thing to go find the Gamora and then maybe lead us into the second and third act.
But you see, that would make the most sense. Because Guardians 2 does set up in the post-credits the Adam Warlock angle, and who in the comic books do we know has an intimate understanding of the Soul Stone? One Mr. Adam Warlock. So, I mean, that would be an interesting way to try to navigate getting a soul out of that stone, so especially if they're still in there. So the other setups we get, obviously Wanda is going off into her own Disney Plus show. Hawkeye's going off into his own Disney Plus show.
To the WandaVision piece real quick, and I still think that title's goofy, but I still believe that Shuri did
finish enough of him.
Her work. And the fact that we didn't have Vision back is because Shuri was gone.
Shuri's
back. I'm sure somebody's got the Vision body on ice somewhere. It would be very much just a quick plot detail saying Shuri came back and fixed it. And he doesn't have the Soul Stone anymore, and he's learning how to be himself again.
That would make sense. That would make narrative sense why he wasn't there in Endgame then. Yeah. You know, so you could have reconstituted him, wasn't there.
Which goes back to my whole thing is I thought everyone was going to live, but I think Tony's the only one who's going to stay dead.
Yeah, well, let's get to the very, very end there, though. Cap takes the stones back. He chooses to live his life with Peggy and passes the shield on to Sam. This was a great, great way to set up their Disney Plus show, Falcon and Winter Soldier. I understand the people who might have wanted Bucky to get the shield, but I think it makes more sense to have Sam take the shield. They both came about there in the same movie there, but I like that, I mentioned this, that Craig and I went to Comic-Con a few years ago with Sebastian Stan, and somebody asked him that in his panel, and he said that he doesn't think Bucky has quite earned the shield yet. He still has to do some good in the world before he feels he's worthy of it. So I think that would be a good thing there. But obviously the movie ends with, what Scott and Craig, you guys were really wanting, which was Cap's dance with Peggy. And I think that is a very fitting way to end phase three. So what are you guys' thoughts on all of this real quick, the Captain America side of how we wrap up and what we're setting up?
It is so hard to be really quick about all this. going back a few scenes before that, you didn't mention and something that I think that we all should be doing is thanking to the altar of John Favreau and allowing us to have that scene with Morgan Stark.
No, I remember it. It just made me very emotional.
giving him a couple of lines, especially the cheeseburger line, callback to Iron Man. Just thanking that man for all that he has done for us, essentially. Because without him and RDJ, this thing wouldn't, and Kevin Feige, obviously.
Well, and without him, you wouldn't have Robert Downey Jr. because he was the only one who went to bat for Robert Downey Jr. when he was making that film.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk Sam and Bucky. If you go back and listen to our podcast before Civil War, I was predicting that Cap would die in that movie and then that we would get hopefully a Sam Wilson Captain America. And I do think that I think that these movies can matter in a way that is beyond the scope of a superhero movie. And I think that that's what you saw, the cultural impact of Black Panther. Mm-hmm. You see Captain Marvel and all these little girls dressed as Captain Marvel. You see just this diversity of different races. You see the diversity of sexual orientation. You see all of this represented in these films, and that matters. And so I think at this moment and at this time, America needs a black Captain America. And I think that Anthony Mackie is the best person to take over this mantle. I mean, look at everything that grows from Winter Soldier on and how much he has grown as a character. And the fact that he isn't a superhero will make a really interesting Captain America. You know, he doesn't have the super strength, but he sure has the heart of a super soldier, right? So I think that it's going to be such a great, great Disney Plus show, but I also think that it could morph into something else in the future. I would love to see a new Avengers with Carol Danvers at the helm, and then you still get a Captain America, Sam Wilson. And just the last thing I'll say is just the little nod that they allowed Sebastian Stan to give as Bucky back to Sam was just so spot on perfect. And I'm really glad for Sam Wilson, Captain America, moving forward.
Well, and I love the fact that Bucky was, I still don't know if he was in on it, but he was in on it. And the fact that throughout this, they're all assuming that Cap is coming right back in 5 seconds, but there's definitely several scenes there or several different takes there where Bucky says, you know, I'm going to miss you. And Steve says, it's going to be all right. He understood what was happening. So the idea that he gives Sam that moment because he already knew what the plan was, was great for that Bucky Steve relationship as much as for the Sam Steve relationship.
Yeah.
And I agree. I think, you could follow the comics and give it to Bucky and then give it to Sam, but I think in the MCU, it makes more sense. And again, I agree. It's time for a Black Captain America.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, do you have any things on how Cap's story ends in this?
Well, first of all, I want to say I called it. at the risk of being obnoxious about that, but yeah.
Well, if you're going to be obnoxious about it, I called it too. So.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's
fine. You're both pretty. Well, actually,
I will say the cutest point and part of my second viewing was I had my daughter next to me, and my daughter has not watched all the MCU films, but she's got an idea. She turns to me halfway through the movie, but he's got the time stone. He can go back and get Peggy. I'm like, you are a smart kid. I love you.
Line her up. But yeah, no, I thought that was a great way to end Chris Evans' time with the franchise. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I got to especially call out the line, you want to tell me about her? And he just very calmly, very smiling, says, nope. No, I don't. I really, really liked that. That, you know, like, it's just, this was just for him, and he's finally earned his dance with Peggy. And you know, not for nothing, but like, Sarah doesn't really like the Captain America movies in the MCU, not for any reason other than, you know, she just not her bag. But I told her about how this film ends with that shot, and she basically just had that, oh, you know, like, teary-eyed thing. So, I mean, like, even she understands, like, the emotional impact of seeing that as the final thing in the series. So, man, well, okay, it's not a Marvel full disclosure without speaking a little bit about what's next for this universe. And for the first time in a long time, man, we don't know a lot about where exactly we're going with this universe. We know a lot of whisperings. We know a lot of writers and directors who've been confirmed, but we don't know release dates. We don't know what's first up on the block. As Scott said, we think it might be Widow, but you know, it could not be. Obviously, we know we've got Spider-Man Far From Home coming in July, which Kevin Feige recently said was the actual cap of Phase 3, which just makes no sense to me, but whatever. Well, you know, he's, well, Kevin Feige, he's our Lord and Savior, so we shall believe him no matter what.
Here's where it makes sense, though. You have a timeline now that is completely toasted, and I don't mean like going back and fixing a space zone. That's going to happen in the Loki show, whatever, but it's obvious that Ned got dusted as well. But how many, and obviously Mary Jane and the other
Flash, folks, all of them, yeah.
So all those guys got dusted, but you just show up in high school after being gone for 5 years. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some issues to deal with. And I think that if they do it right, that Spider-Man will be able to kind of
that can be deal with those issues. Film, yeah.
So we can move past the whole, we're now in 2023 thing. So we're not dealing with that for 15 movies.
And Tony's death. I mean, that obviously play a huge impact there too. And Nick Fury coming into that more of a mentor, father figure kind of role for him. So I think that in a way, and that's the thing. That's why this is a controversial statement, but like, I'm okay with Natasha being dead and staying dead. Like, I'm okay with starting to move on from these original six because they've had their moment in the sun at this point, and I'm ready for the next Avengers. I'm ready for the next. And so I don't want the next phase to be just going back in and basically changing a lot of the things that happened in Endgame. I want that to be the bookend, and then I want to move forward at this point.
Feige disagrees with you because Black Widow has a director and they're going to start filming in the summer.
And that's why it's a prequel.
Unless it's a prequel, man.
That's just, obviously there will be points of it which will be a prequel, but you do much like I yelled at Jeremy a few weeks ago, you don't take a $1 billion franchise and write it off. You don't kill Doctor Strange because Doctor Strange is worth $1 billion. You don't just make a prequel Black Widow when Scarlett Johansson is a bankable actor. You don't do it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the rest of the supposed thing, I mean, look, we know that Coogler has been signed up to do Black Panther 2. We know James Gunn's been brought back to do Guardians of the Galaxy 3. We know they've hired a screenwriter and a director for Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu.
Eternals is coming too quickly.
Eternals, yeah, that's one.
And then also the director for Doctor Strange is doing Doctor Strange,
Scott,
too.
That was Scott Derrickson. Scott Derrickson, I think, was signed up for Doctor Strange, too. So these are all things we know. And we have no clue where they're going to fall at all, because Kevin Feige and Marvel has been famously tight-lipped about what's going to happen after Endgame. And I think that that's a great call, and I don't mind it. And honestly, I think all of us are pretty much expecting that to shake out at D23 this year.
It'll be a heck of a panel at D23. Although I think it'll be a different – I think Kevin Feige and Disney and Marvel are I don't think that they're anxious to go back to an El Capitan type presentation, because you go back and see how many of those movies actually happened.
Yeah.
I doubt that it'll be a 5-year plan as such. I think it'll be much more little snippets or little thoughts about each of these movies. And I really do think that on some level, these are going to become more standalone, as opposed to, I don't think that they're going to obviously blow up the MCU, but I don't know that it's going to be so reliant on some kind of main centralized story arc moving forward.
No, I think phase 3 shows you what they're going to do. It's going to be team ups. It's going to be Hulk and Thor. Now it's going to be Thor and the Guardians. It's going to be folks we can sprinkle in throughout, but I do think we'll get a new Avengers sooner or later. But going back to the El Capitan, I agree with you. They're probably not going to do a 5-year plan again. But the only one that didn't happen was Inhumans, and
yeah, that's because Spider-Man.
Feige didn't want to do Inhumans. Inhumans was because Perlmutter was making him do it. Yeah. And as soon as Disney split Marvel Studios from Marvel Comics, Perlmutter had nothing to say anymore. So Inhumans went away.
Yeah.
So that was before Kevin Feige was fully in charge of the franchise.
And I mean, like that's what we all know and stuff. But I mean, like I think that the movie that did, but I mean, like their official excuse was Spider-Man. You know, we've got that now, so we have to move everything down and I don't know, blah blah.
That wasn't even I think you're construing. That wasn't even an official thing. Inhumans went to a TV show because Perlmutter was told you were going to make a TV show.
Yeah, but. Yeah, either way. But you are right. That was the only film in that that did not actually get made. I think one of the dates got switched around or something.
A lot of the dates got switched. And so I just think that I don't know that you're going to see a master plan. I think you're going to see a potential roadmap, but it won't be like a legitimate, like, on the screen, here are our next 8 movies.
Yeah. I'd just be surprised don't think that's going to happen.
The one thing I will say is everyone's saying that X-Men and Fantastic Four will not be showing up for a very long time. I don't think that's the case. I think they will give X-Men a little time to breathe. I still question if Dark Phoenix is actually going to show up in theaters, but I think you're going to get at least a Fantastic Four insert into something, if not their own title, fairly quickly. Because I think, for one, Kevin Feige has said that's his favorite team in the Marvel universe, but also I think Disney's going to realize that we need to capitalize on these new franchises that we have. And X-Men's still bankable, even though they can't be done correctly by Fox anymore.
Well, and I can't remember who I don't want to say Feige. I think it might have been, but like somebody at Marvel Studios said, you know, like we're not planning on doing anything with those for multiple years. But again, I don't know if that was confirmed or if it was on background or whatever. But yeah, like that's where that report you're referencing comes from, Scott.
But we're multiple years out on everything. I mean, we're multiple years. We've got Far From Home. We'll probably have one movie. I think the days of two MCU movies a year are probably limited. I think that going forward, it probably will become more of a one a year kind of thing. I don't think that they're going to want that superhero movie bubble to burst.
They started doing 3 a year a couple of years ago, and so yeah. I can definitely see them going down to 2 and maybe a few years just one. But
again, this is why you guys don't run studios, and I don't run a studio either. But they don't care about a bubble; they care about making money. And as long as these are making money, they will continue to pump them out. So you're going to get 2 or 3 a year, especially now that Fox is off the playing field and Disney can use their franchises and Sony is being a good little, you know, kid with Spider-Man. They're going to continue to pump these out. And if you're thinking you're going to get one a year now.
I'm just saying, I'm assuming that Kevin Feige and Kathleen Kennedy have lunch sometimes. And she just went through a pretty nasty,
but that's because she didn't handle it correctly.
Her franchise.
Sure. But that's because she picked terrible movies. If you start picking terrible movies. Yeah. But Solo was a bad decision. And that's not because anyone who says Star Wars is getting – people can't handle two Star Wars films a year. Again, we've had three Marvel movies, and they've all made tons of money. The fact that Star Wars is floundering is because they made poor decisions.
I'd say the difference is quality. Marvel is known for quality.
And, I mean, even though I do like The Last Jedi a lot, I understand that they made a poor decision in making that so divisive. Marvel hasn't done that. And until Marvel does that, they're going to continue to pump these out.
Yeah. So let's get into our wrap ups here. It's, you know, we've been talking for a while about this movie, and I mean, there's not a lot to complain about in this movie. It is an insanely thoroughly satisfying movie experience, and audiences are coming in droves on that. The first estimate said it might be 300 million. Now they're going to 350 is around where they're saying the top on this might be. It's looking like, I think the last report I read is that it's definitely going to clear $1 billion worldwide in its opening weekend, which would just obliterates the record. Now they're starting to talk about setting its sights on Avatar. I just don't ever know if anything's going to do that, because you have to be in theaters for 9 months, it seems, to be able to do that, like it's Avatar just a was. World. But I mean, like, look, the money this movie is making is stupid good. And that might be the thing in its favor, and why I think that the movie makes such an impact. It's not because I have a friend, Trevor, who went and saw this on Friday on opening night with a bunch of people. He's never seen one Marvel Cinematic Universe film, but he went to see this one because it's an event. This is the thing that people are talking about. And I think the fact that you have that kind of hype around this movie and that kind of expectations, and the fact that the Russo brothers, it can never be stated enough what those two men did for this MCU, because they have guided so many of the guiding stories, like the crux stories of this universe, to successful conclusions, whether it's Winter Soldier or Civil War or Infinity War or Endgame here. The number of the sheer volume of the awesomeness of the movies that they have made cannot ever be understated. And that's really kind of another thought that I took away from this movie, aside from just the enthrallingness of it, is just, man, the Russo brothers absolutely nailed every single thing they ever did with Marvel, and they have earned their break on it. So this movie does live up to the hype. It is well worth it, and I am looking forward to seeing it many times.
My last unpopular opinion, and this might be throwing a bomb and running away from it, but I really, and I understand, wholeheartedly understand, you don't know when a 95-year-old is going to pass away, but I kind of wish, go with me here, I kind of wish that Spidey Into the Spider-Verse was Stan's last cameo, because to me, Captain Marvel's cameo, I love Kevin Smith to death, it wasn't like a thing for me, and then this cameo was really not a thing for me. But man, if you've seen Spider-Verse and you see him going like, oh, did you know that we were friends? Oh, the suit always fits eventually. Like, oh my God, what a perfect cameo. But so that's my last unpopular opinion, because everyone loves Stan, and I love Stan too. But I think that Captain Marvel and Endgame, I wish that we would have had just a better end to that than we did. But there's that.
Okay.
no opinions on it at all.
Steve, final thoughts on the film?
Again, it's just so satisfying. It may not be the best film in the series, but I'm not saying it's not either. But it's just amazing how many different elements are there that will satisfy literally everybody that's watched these movies. Mm-hmm. And it's way more satisfying of a series closer, if you think about the Avengers, than a lot of other series have ended. So I think history will look kindly on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, what about you?
I will say it's the best one. After rewatching it, I was kind of questioning where it would fall, but the rewatchability of just the fun, the hope, the ability to kind of tie everything together, and all the homages, and again, the set pieces. This is a movie that can be rewatched over and over again, and I think it is if we redid our MCU ranking for a third time, it's at the top.
Yep, absolutely. Craig, do you have any other film specific, like just overall things aside from Stan?
No, I'd say just a 10 out of 10 from me, whatever our ranking scale is.
Kick us off there. Out of 10, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was the perfect, to me, it was the perfect cap to everything that has come before it. And so that's where I'm at with it. And that's why I am more hesitant about wanting to continue some of these storylines forward. I kind of want to see something new emerge from the cinematic universe going forward. But this to me was just perfect. And I have little gripes here and there, but that's just me trying to be nitpicky. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. I sat through 6 hours of a film over a 2-day time period, you know, and I wouldn't have done that unless I absolutely loved this. And so it was great.
Great. Steve, what for you out of 10?
I'd give it a solid 9 out of 10. Nothing for me will ever beat the original Avengers, because you can only meet that team once. And for me, that's still the pinnacle. But this was probably a lot better than it had any right to be, with all of the lines tying up and the dialogue. And it you would think that it could collapse very easily under its own weight, and it did far, far from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, out of 10.
6.16 out of 10.
Yeah?
No one got that reference.
We got it. did you notice that was the storage?
Yes, it was. It was Lang. It says Lang 616, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
For the noobs playing, 616 is the number of the universe that's actually the comic universe.
There you go.
16 is it 1610 is the ultimate universe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 616.
All right. Well, it behooves me to ever give 10 out of 10 to a film. I never do it, and I'm going to this time, just because I can't stop thinking about every single aspect of this movie and how it connects into what came before, and it's just an amazing thing. So I'm giving it 10 out of 10. I'm with Craig here, and this is going to be a standard bearer for me for a long time, for any kind of blockbuster film and pretty much any other film as well. So, all right, let's call it a quits here on Avengers Endgame. Well, everybody just go and see it 1,500 more times, because this definitely deserves to be the highest grossing movie of all time, and not fake Pocahontas. So let's
Fern Gully.
Yeah, fake Fern Gully. Let's all make a commitment to that. If you want to find more from the Front Row Network, you can find us on our website, frnpod.com. Search for us on social media, Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, or Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. And of course, as I said at the beginning, we are now an NPR podcast. What? So you'll be able to find us there on the NPR sites very soon as well. And in the future, if you want more from the Front Row Network, come right back here tomorrow night, because we are live breaking down Game of Thrones Episode 3, The Battle of Winterfell, The Row Knows Nothing. As if this geek weekend didn't need to get bigger, now we're going to get The Battle of Winterfell. So we're going to be live here on YouTube tomorrow night breaking all of that down as well. Anybody got anything else before we kick off?
After that, what? They might be questioning NPR status. they might knock us off.
I question their decision-making skills.
Yeah, already. So. I mean, you know, they have no clue what they're in for. All right, well, that's going to do it here. We got to get out of here, everyone. For the Front Row Network, I'm Jeremy Gechner.
Craig McFarlane.
Steve Sykes.
There you go. I got nothing. I'm good.
And of course, as always, we will see you in the front row. Bye bye, everyone.
We love you 3000.